Yes.
On the previous slide, you mentioned something about misbehaving in those parts. What is misbehaving?
It basically means you'll get particles that have behavior that is very non-physical that you can tell don't really work. But again, I can't give you a good feeling for that because I'm not a string theorist, so I haven't done those calculations. But my understanding is you'll get things that come out of the theory that only go away when you're working in 10 dimensions. And these things are so bad that they know that any viable theory that would describe nature simply couldn't be in that dimensionality. And I think it's proven it only works in 10 dimensions. Okay, another thing that has come out in string theory is that this idea of little strings turns out that you can have other types of structures in string theories once you're making these big geometrical models. So, for example, people talk about different number structures with different dimensionality. So you can have a larger scale, larger dimensional theory, like 10-dimensional theory, and within that you can have multi-dimensional structures like 0 or 1 or 2 or 3-dimensional structures, which go by the name of brains. So a 3-brain, for example, would be what we perceive. But we could have this basically situated in a 10-dimensional theory, and you know, we can't perceive the 10 dimensions, but within the theory you can have something that is very much like what we would perceive as the world around us in a 3-brain, for example. You can have some interesting things happen with this because you can have, for example, some types of particles constrained to be stuck on those certain structures. So, for example, you can have some particles that are constrained to only be available inside the 3-brain and not be able to go into those other dimensions, for example. And other particles that can go into those other structures. So there's the idea of having some particles stuck on a 3-brain. So this might be basically what we perceive as our reality, and the particles that we're used to, that we're made up of, that carry the forces that we're used to, move around in that space but can't actually move into, for example, another dimension, the 11th dimension. Some particles maybe can. So, for example, gravitons perhaps can go through into the 11th dimension. And one of the reasons that gravity is such a weak force compared to the others is sometimes thought perhaps to be that as a possibility. And one of the multiverses we talked about at the end of class last time was this very strange idea that you could have two 3-brains, so two realities very similar to what we experience, separated by an 11th dimension, that basically have a force between them so that they'll move apart and then get attracted back together. But when they collide, that there can be an enormous energy release so that it would look throughout all of the space of the 3-brain like a big bang is happening all at once. But there's no inflation. There's not things starting from a point. You can have the space within the 3-brain constantly expanding, and it just turns out that when it collides with the other 3-brain, you get an enormous energy deposition, and the space would still be expanding, and it would look very much like what we see as the start of our big bang. You can get energy asymmetries or fluctuations in the space structure where you have hot and cold spots by having these two spaces affect each other a little bit and begin to crinkle, so you get some spots hitting a little bit before other spots. And so when you do this research, I mean, they've found ways, I don't know to what extent they have to tune it or to what extent it's natural, but they found ways in which they can show that the pattern of fluctuations you would get in the energy looks a whole lot like what we see on the cosmic microwave background. And there are experiments being done which might distinguish this type of picture from inflationary hot Big Bang models. And so this is, for example, a a competitor to the hot Big Bang model, but it's an idea that's out there. And this is string theory inspired. I mean, it's a... One of the fun things about this idea is that it allows these three-dimensional brains to basically cycle. So you'll have collision. Now it's like a Big Bang in this space. The space within this three brain is expanding. The three brains move apart. This space is expanding and flattens out as the wrinkles in the space-time from this other one get slowly flattened out. So it has flat space, just like we see in our universe. And the galaxies and everything form, and everything moves apart. And over time, it looks very much like our universe does. You can even put dark energy in and have the expansion accelerating. In the meantime, you have this other brain moving away. You could have the same thing happening there, as far as I know. And then there's this inter-brain force that will cause them to come back and collide. What that is, I don't think anybody knows. I mean, they make something up, but I think it's a parameter in their theory. And then this will come back and collide, so they have these two flat brains approach each other and develop crinkles as they get close to one another, and then they collide and everything happens again. So it's a completely cyclic model where you have the universe go through this cycle and then it all starts over again. Yeah?
As those start going towards each other colliding, does independently, if each universe was expanding, then they start tricking in on themselves as well as they start coming together, or does it doesn't really matter?
They always overlap. They're separated in this 11th dimension. So in a sense, so you can think of them as being, apparently they get slightly offset in the 11th dimension. So we don't perceive them because our particles can't move through the bulk into that other brain, and theirs can't come to ours, as far as I know, and so we can't see it. The photons that we have in our brain can't get there. So what can happen, I believe, is they can talk to each other gravitationally a little bit. So I don't know what that does with the overlap, and I don't do this for a living, so I don't know to what extent. But I seem to recall that they actually only get separated by a little bit. And the space is fairly flat when they begin to get closer. So it's a little bit of a strange thing to think of these three dimensions sort of separated in this 11th dimension, and you have this distance in the 11th dimension, and you can have interactions between them be a function of that. So apparently the idea is that you can have slight quantum fluctuations that as they get very close, those quantum fluctuations can cause some parts to be a little closer than other parts, and you can get bigger interactions there, and this is what begins to cause the crinkling or something like that. So, I don't know. Yeah, I'm not a big expert on this. But if you are interested, you will find several references in Visions of the Multiverse, so I give a whole list of those. And then there's the article that Steinhardt just wrote, which also has some references in there. Anything else on that? Yes?
Is this the multiverse then? Because they don't seem causally disconnected.
That's an interesting question. I call it a multiverse where the multiverse part is the parts that are separated in time, and they are causally disconnected. More, I mean, you do have one and then it will create the other, so they're maybe not causally connected right at the start of each. But it's not a multiverse the way that I've defined it in terms of one brain and another brain. I thought of actually calling that a multiverse at one point, and then I thought that they can talk to each other gravitationally, so they are not causally disconnected. Then I thought of calling that a pseudo-multiverse. I thought, well, that's starting to go. It'll be a bit of a stretch. So, yeah. So it's the cyclic piece that's the multiverse in this one. I do believe there's room within it to have a full three-space universe and another full three-space universe that can only talk to each other in this tenuous sort of way with some gravitational interaction and whatever this force is that moves them in the 11th dimension. So you might think of that as a multiverse of some form. Okay, so it turns out that so in string theory we know we live in three spatial dimensions plus time. The mathematics in the theory has to be working in 10 dimensions. So that means we have to make 6 of those dimensions go away and be compactified, and then there's reason to believe that there is an 11th dimension that any of these theories can fit into. But, you know, whether we're compactifying 5 or 6, you know, makes no difference to me. I'm not a string theorist. But the idea is you have many dimensions that you have to make go away. And it turns out that within these theories, the basic particle spectrum, the nature of the forces, the laws of the physics, the strength of the electric charge, the nature of the forces themselves is really dictated by the way in which you compactify these extra dimensions. That's where things like the electric charge come from. So it's an interesting throwback to the ancient Greeks in that it's really a geometrical interpretation of reality. It's one of the things people find very appealing about general relativity that we've talked about is the fact that gravitation is interpreted as a distortion of space-time, and that's sort of a beautiful thing because it's you're taking this geometry and you're elegantly explaining gravity with it. And so many people believe that's really a beautiful thing, and truthfully this kind of thing goes way back to the ancient Greeks, who thought that planets had to be on these perfect spherical shells because that's a perfect geometrical shape. Why? I don't know. I mean, I guess people have always wanted their explanation for things to be beautiful in our eyes. Since we're a product of such a universe, that there's a correlation between what we perceive as beautiful and what seems to describe nature well, I should stop back. There seems to be a correlation between what we usually perceive as beautiful in physics theories and reality. That actually is true, and it has, and many people have pondered why that might be. We can ponder why that might be if you want. I certainly have no answer. It, to me, is a little bit also maybe a chicken and egg sort of problem. I mean, we have evolved in this world, so it may be that what we perceive of as beautiful is partly part of the world because that's what we became, where we came from. I don't know. So in a funny way, we've sort of come a full circle. We start with the ancient Greeks and their ideas about the universe based on geometry, and now all of a sudden we're back, and in string theory, the structure of our universe in detail boils down to geometry and how these extra dimensions are actually compactified. So again, since this is true, the hope was there might be a best way of doing that. So an analogy, we have to talk about energy. If you have all these dimensions that you have to compactify and you have lots of different ways of doing it, it turns out that different ways of compactifying these dimensions are not all equal. Some of them you have more energy stored in the vacuum than in others. If you think of energy being what twists the space, sort of like in a general relativity sort of sense. So So not all of these ideas of how to compactify things are equal. And just to get an idea of that, we often use a concept of potential energy in physics. And what we mean by that is sort of energy that's stored in a configuration, whatever it is. So you can imagine having a spring just sitting here at its natural length, uncompressed and unstretched. We could say that has a potential energy of zero. And then if we compress it, now the spring has within it the capacity to do work. That is, if I let it go, it'll push something. It'll actually do something. So it has within it stored energy. So we can talk about quantifying the energy of the spring as a function of the spring length. Let me go on with springs for a minute. I wanted to switch to balls. We can do the same thing with a ball or a book or something, where the energy stored in the book depends on where it is. If I lift it up, it has potential energy because I can drop it and it'll smash something. If it's down low or sitting on the ground, then it has less potential energy or none. So if you imagine having a ball on a hill where there's a dip. So we have a ball and we have a bit of a hill here and here. We can actually talk about the gravitational potential energy stored in the ball by virtue of its position. So if it's at the bottom, we say that it has a minimum of potential energy because if we let it go, it's not going to go anywhere. It's not going to roll or do anything. So there's no energy actually stored in it at that point. If we roll it up the hill a little bit, so if we move this ball over to this position, now it's got stored potential energy because if I let that go, it'll roll, it'll do things. So this idea is very commonly used in physics to analyze problems. So the idea is that the way to talk about the differences in the ways that things are compactified in all of these multiple dimensions is to talk about the stored energy or the potential energy of the vacuum, or we shorten it to the vacuum potential. Okay? And so the thought was initially that perhaps physicists would discover that there is ultimately a most favored configuration where the potential is very low. And no matter how you tried to configure the vacuum, it would have lots of potential energy stuck in it, and it would sort of reconfigure itself into a lowest energy state. And if you found that, maybe you would find that that geometry actually describes the universe as we see it. And you could go, whoa, I just discovered, you know, the theory of everything. I just found the theory that explains why the electric charge is what it is, why the gravitational force is what it is, and, you know, why the particle mass spectrum is what it is. So this was really what drove the excitement in string theory for many years. People were hoping to do this. In this idea, one of the things that you hope to find, if you look at our universe, we have lots of choices that seem to have been made for these various particle spectra and things like the electric charge, the mass of the neutron, the mass of the proton. After the fact, when we look back at it, you go, wow, if things weren't quite like that, we wouldn't be here. So for our universe to really be as we know it, a lot of things have to be just right. And they seem to be arbitrarily just right. I mean, there's no good reason for it. So one of the things people hoped to find was the reason why things are as finely tuned as they seem to be. So the problem comes in, just like any topological problem, if you're this idea of the ball rolling in the dip, I mean, if we go out and we find a little hill, a little dip over in the parking lot or something, we can do this thing with the ball. But now let's say we want to think about a large landscape. If you want to just roll the ball from here to Rush Reese, for example, you're going to find not one dip. You're going to find lots of dips where that ball is happy to settle. Okay? And so mathematically, if you look at how you can reconfigure all the various parameters that basically tell you how the space is twisted together, how it's compactified, and you look at how the energy of the vacuum depends on those things, you find not just one local minimum, you find other local minima. So you can have regions where you would have local stability. So a dip up on top of a mountain, for example, this ball is perfectly happy to go sit in that dip on top of the mountain, and it won't go anywhere unless there's this massive earthquake or something, right? So this is really a problem, because with all of the parameters that it takes to describe how one might compactify six dimensions, you get about an estimate of about 10^500 different possibilities. And so if you were to take any measure of trying to figure out how one if you try to visualize how the energy corresponds to all of these different parameter sets, you end up with things like local minima. I mean, let's just start out with try to think of a good way to do this. Suppose that we start out in a universe that has only two parameters, okay? One is this direction and one is that direction. So let's say these parameters describe how space gets twisted, whatever it is. If we are in a universe that has a certain position this way and a certain position this way, so I'm sitting right here, the space gets stable, and there's a certain energy in the vacuum. There might be another place where, had we started over there, we would have ended up over there. But in between, there are regions where, in order for me to get over there, I would have to put a lot of energy into the vacuum to change the parameters in order to get over there. So you might have a local minimum over there and a local minimum over here, and I can't get from here to there very easily. Wherever it is, I mean, you're starting someplace. So in order to have an ultimate minimum, so to have the ultimate theory of everything, you basically have to have, wherever you start, you have to be able to feed down into that particular minimum. So it would work if the parameter space was like the sides, if everything was like the sides of a smooth bowl. Then no matter where you start, the vacuum will configure itself into this one ultimate state. But it's not that way. Some of these have low energies and some have high energies. So the parameter space looks much more like this. You have these local minima where things ought to be quasi-stable. Okay, so here is from one of the articles. I think it was it's an article called The String Theory Landscape, which I put on your list. So I've got some figures from that. So the idea is, depending on how these extra dimensions happen to get twisted together and compactified, it's a topological problem, you'll get the vacuum energy, or the energy of the space basically depends on exactly how that twisting is done. And there are lots of different ways to do it. So in the end, you end up with a visualization of, you can't see it in this lighting, but there are slight differences in here, 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 and here. There are some lines drawn which the pattern is a little bit different. So these actually represent four different ways of compactifying the extra dimensions. And these all might be stable in that they are local minima if you look at how the energy depends on the parameters that are used to do the compactification. So if you started out with some arbitrary space of six dimensions and said, okay, I'm going to wrap them this way, you might find four different solutions where things are stable. But the energies may vary and they're separated. This idea is called the string theory landscape. It's a landscape of possible solutions to how to do the compactification. And the fact is that many of them would in principle be stable. They can shift from one to another a little bit because in quantum mechanics, you have a possibility of something happening that we don't typically have in just balls on mountains. Remember that we don't think of a ball as a ball in quantum mechanics. We think of it as like this wave function where you have some probability of being anywhere where that wave function is. So you can have a hill like this, and there's very small but non-zero probability that the ball will actually end up over here with quantum mechanics. It turns out that this is exactly the way we interpret alpha decay in nuclei. It's a strange sort of thing. It's called quantum tunneling. I don't want to get too hung up on this, but basically within quantum mechanics, what it says is that we can have a certain string theory solution that's stable that actually can, via quantum mechanics, reconfigure into a different stable solution. So there is some crosstalk between these different minima. And this is the mechanism that people use to talk about shifting from inflation to non-inflation and things like that with a bubble multiverse. So you can imagine starting out with some space-time where you have a configuration that looks like this, and then the space you have compactification and get a stable thing here, or you can get a stable thing here, and then you might have quantum tunneling in time that can cause the characteristics of the universe to shift. So in places you can have shifting in the characteristics. So you can have, for example, some place where you have an inflating reality, and then in a certain point you can have a quantum fluctuation causing the space in that point to change its characteristics and actually go to where you don't have inflation. So this is the idea of how the bubble multiverse basically would come in. You can tie this in with the whole idea of bubble multiverse. So you can different, some configurations of this compactification are such that you will have inflation happening, and some you will not have inflation happening, or you might just have expansion like what we have in our universe. So it's these types of changes that can cause the basic changing of the characteristics in the space-time, allowing different bubble multiverses to pop up. The other thing is, if you go from a place where you have inflation to a place where you don't have inflation happening, we would call that the creation of a bubble multiverse. They don't all have to be at the same point in the string theory landscape, which means in each bubble multiverse, you can have very different physical laws. You can have a different electric charge, or you can have, you know, masses of protons and neutrons can be different, or the forces could have different characteristics. So that's why people talk about the bubble multiverse as having all of these different physical characteristics. Okay, so here's a visualization of what I was trying to say. So we have an area of space-time where there's a certain solution of the compactification, and that vacuum has a potential energy which acts as a repulsive force and causes inflation to be happening. So we have this inflating reality happening here, and all of a sudden, at one point in the space-time, you'll get a quantum fluctuation in the way that this thing is twisted, such that you get a more stable configuration. The potential energy drops, and inflation can stop there, and you can have slow expansion, and that can lead to a bubble multiverse within the reality, the larger inflating reality. And then within this, you can have another fluctuation. So within this picture, we have this sort of layers of bubbles and regions where you can have the vacuum changing. And our universe is within one of those bubbles. It's not exactly a common occurrence to have these fluctuations happening, causing something different. So the region we're in is very large. So within this strange sort of picture, we have space-time with one sort of compactification here. It had within it a couple of quantum fluctuations, one of which is this green one, and another is this red one, where the compactification changed its form a little bit, and the characteristics of the physical laws and the degree to which inflation is happening there changed. Then within here, for example, you had another one. Within this, you had several other fluctuations. This fluctuation happened to create space that has all the characteristics of our space-time, what we see as our universe. And then within that, in a small region of it, there's a region that is the size of our visible universe. So that's sort of the picture of this bubble multiverse. So you can have bubbles within bubbles, and it's pretty wacky. There are 10^500 different possibilities estimated for ways in which this configuration can happen. And the thought is that, I don't remember what I had next, the thought is that all of those possibilities get sampled in this great reality of things sort of fluctuating around. So rather than discovering one unique solution that explains why our universe is the way it is, what they appear to be saying, what they are saying, is that, well, all possibilities are populated. So we will certainly find ourselves in one of the possibilities where we can exist. Anything that could happen does happen in this idea of the multiverse. And this is, we have no direct experimental evidence of anything that string theory says. I mean, first of all, it's not a theory that is on the same level of experimental confirmation that we have for relativity or cosmology in general. And other things we talked about. String theory is a really cool set of ideas that are well motivated using a lot of physical techniques and mathematical techniques, but they've yet to predict something that we have been able to go out and find that says, okay, that's real experimental evidence for string theory. But this idea of the multiverse, this idea, we call it the cosmic landscape or the string theory landscape, comes directly from the string theory ideas. There's a question up there first. It's produced at a point, so there'll be a point in space where one of the parameters, a quantum fluctuation, one of those parameters will sort of cause a quick shift in the compactification scheme or whatever it is. And then the characteristics of that space at that point has changed. And it can, in a sense, collide. I mean, if it's, for example, in space where you don't have inflation happening, and all of a sudden at that point inflation begins to happen, I mean, it's going to heat up that other region of space. So you can have bubbles collide.
Can quantum fluctuation happen just like right outside?
It's happening all around you all the time. But this type of reconfiguration of the space, I think is fairly unusual. So I don't think you get quantum fluctuations that actually cause this type of vacuum reconfiguration. I don't think that's very... I'm not an expert. I can't tell you how often, but that kind of thing is not happening all the time. You'll get quantum fluctuations in all the parameters, but if we are at a stable enough minimum, you will not get a quantum fluctuation that is so big, because the bigger the fluctuation, the less often it happens, that it gets you to some other minimum and therefore cause at that point a literal reconfiguration into another stable space. So what will happen is you'll get these fluctuations, but you'll basically just keep being driven back to the solution where you currently are. I think, yeah, most of the time they are. I mean, maybe I have to eat my words a little bit, because in the sense that if you could imagine having a space here where maybe inflation isn't happening or isn't happening as fast, and you have a fluctuation where it happens a little bit faster, and this basically will eat that, I don't know if we call that, I guess that's a causal connection of some form. I don't know what exactly happens at that boundary or how you would know. But the picture I usually have of the bubble multiverse is you have an inflating reality here because it's getting so much bigger, so faster. If you have a region where inflation slows down and another region where inflation slows down, I mean, they get separated enormously fast. So, yeah. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I was going to say...
Okay.
I'll tell you about it once.
Sure. All right, so... Oh, go for it.
Are there a lot of physicists that like, disagree with the principle of string theory? Like, is there like any doubt, or is it just that there hasn't been experimental evidence? Like, are there some people that like, see their problems with that, is what I'm saying?
You know, sometimes you ask these questions that are real, real zingers. Because, you know, that's really interesting. Some people are almost religiously fanatic about string theory for many of the compelling reasons I've tried to paint for you. Other people are a little bit like, you know, beautiful theories come, beautiful theories go. Show me a real prediction and let's go out. And when I see something that agrees with that, then I'll listen to you. So this comes up at times when, you know, if you waltz into a faculty meeting in the physics department and say, let's hire a string theorist, you'll get these two camps all of a sudden, and it's almost a religious divide. And I actually have a lot of sympathy for the string theorists because there is almost no place in science where intuition and aesthetic opinion doesn't matter. It really does. And it's sort of funny because you don't really think of science that way, but people work on problems that interest them and they'll look for elegant solutions. I mean, what do you mean by elegant? What do you mean by beautiful? People are working on theories, they'll look for a solution that takes fewer steps, has more symmetry to it in some weird sort of way. And almost universally, people will gravitate toward that as the preferred solution. And so if I'm looking at a theory that sort of seems ad hoc and one that seems elegant and beautiful, and they both make predictions and I'm an experimentalist, I'm going to bias myself trying to figure out a way to identify whatever this, you know, I'm going to build an experiment to go find that instead of the ugly one. And, you know, it doesn't always work out, but it does seem that nature goes that way enough. So right now, it's really gut instinct and aesthetic sense that's driving the string theorists. But there are many people who would say string theory belongs in a math department, not in a physics department, because, oh, it's cool math. I actually do think there's common ground in the middle, because string theory has got a lot of really smart people developing really interesting techniques, and some of those techniques they are actually being able to use to make more standard calculations. It turns out that they've discovered some pretty interesting connections between quantum field theory, which people do think of as real physics, and string theory. So there are ways in which you can take a quantum field theory-like problem and use techniques to couch it in terms of more of a string theory thing, do a calculation, and then sort of push it back and enable you to do a calculation that you couldn't otherwise do in quantum field theory. So there, you know, it is beginning to gain some real legitimacy in the eyes of some of these hard-ass physicists, I guess, if you think about it. But it is just a theory, and so I don't quite put it up there with the beyond the horizon idea, but it ties in very nicely with the idea of inflation, which seems to be driven by cosmology. So I do sort of think of this as a scientifically inferred multiverse, because it ties in pretty nicely. But you know, you have to be pretty careful if you're calling string theory science at this point. It might be someday, and it may be maybe all these biases are actually correct. Okay, so that the theorists have. All right, so this is a bit of I was attempting to throw up some thoughts here. So this cosmic, we call this 10 to the 500 ways to do the compactification, the cosmic landscape or the string theory landscape. Maybe some aren't populated. I don't know. This brings up a lot of questions. You know, there's this idea of intelligent design. Some people find the fact that our universe seems so contrived and fine-tuned as proof of the existence of a creator. And they view the idea of looking at scientifically how fine-tuned the universe to be as sort of a scientific way of showing a creator existed. And this is the idea of intelligent design, which is being pushed as as something that should be taught on an equal footing as most science theories in the curriculum in the United States and elsewhere. This particular idea of basically having all of these possibilities populated, therefore meaning everything can happen, goes up directly against the idea of intelligent design, in the sense that there's nothing contrived or strange about us being in our universe. All possibilities happen, and we will be in one where we can exist. Therefore, we will find ourselves in one that appears to be contrived, if in fact it takes that kind of contrived set of constants to allow carbon-based life to exist. So that's the basic idea. Does that say God doesn't exist? I don't think so, because, I mean, it might. If you are into very strict reading of Scripture and there's something that you read there that makes it sound like our universe is unique, then I think the whole multiverse idea has to bother you. Okay? But, you know, if God is all-powerful, God could work through a multiverse. So I don't see that it's particularly an anti-religious statement, but the cosmic landscape and intelligent design do sort of collide, I think. So what do you think? Is this even science anymore? What does this mean about a theory of everything? Do you believe there should be a theory of everything? No? What do you think?
It just seems to me like all this. It just seems like everything is just so subjective that you can't, like, how can
sometimes divorcing like perception from like this kind of like objective reality in math. Do you know what I mean? Like I have a tough time like distinguishing between the two because my reality, I just feel like my reality is so different from like Val's reality, is different from your reality, but like I just feel like it's this to like kind of say that there's a theory of everything. I don't know, it's just like weird to me. Like, that probably doesn't make any sense, but, like...
Well, no, it does, and I mean... But let me take the other point of view. So all of us can do a calculation, you know, a projectile problem using Newtonian physics. Well, in principle, we can, right? And we'll come up with, you know, we'll have very set formalism and rules, and we would get the same answer. And so we must be describing something about reality with that. And that we can share. So where does the line get drawn? Yeah?
I think it's interesting. It's just like, I feel like throughout the course you've always been talking about like this, not obsession, but this like strong tend towards this like beautiful symmetric equations. I remember one, didn't we have two different equations that worked for something? I don't remember what was way back when. There were two different ways. You said one was more complicated. I don't even remember what it was for.
There's when we talked about quantum mechanics, I know there were two approaches, one of which was so mathematical, even most physicists were having trouble with it, and another was more like a wave theory, Schrodinger's approach. I think another time we may have done it was talking about Newtonian gravity and general relativity. I don't know.
I feel like there's such a bias that people are like very like looking for this beautiful formula, and I wonder if like if people looked it for a more messy one, or I don't know, I just feel like there's like a disproportionate amount of focus on that. I don't know.
Maybe. I mean, I think that would be fair criticism that some people would throw at some physicists.
Like I feel like a theory of everything would be this beautiful complex, obviously. I wouldn't understand that equation, but like I doubt that would be a messy equation. I mean, obviously it's messy and complicated, but it would definitely, don't you imagine it would be a really symmetric, I don't know.
Well, I would like to think that if we found the theory of everything, it would be an elegant and beautiful sort of thing. I mean, that's a bias I have. Yeah, definitely.
I feel like it's kind of like a religious belief for physicists.
It is. It is. Well, you might have implicit in it an inability to really fully predict the future of any given isolated thing. So quantum mechanics sort of has that. If I take a small system, I think you can... But as you get larger systems and you sample things statistically, quantum mechanics gives you a really good description. So what is the goal? Is there an external reality that is independent of us? You talk about your reality and her reality and my reality being a little different. Is that true? Or is it that you perceive reality to be a little different from her perception of reality, which is a little different from my perception of reality, but that perception might be a little bit different, but that there exists a reality that is independent of us perceiving it? What do you think?
Doesn't that delve right into like religious concepts? Because like Buddhists and Hindus, they also have similar kinds of ideas. So it seems very, very close to metaphysics or religion. So, and I don't know how any of this can really be falsified or it can really be repeated through experimentation.
I agree with everything you say. This is really, It's philosophy, metaphysics, religion. So is there a reality that is actually independent of us? And then we may perceive it as individuals to be a little different. We may describe it in different ways, but that there is a fundamental reality that's independent of us. That's really a question. Yeah.
My major seminar with Professor DiPiero, he actually mentioned a conversation he had with me about the multiverse and stuff. But we often talk about metaphysics, the whole class is about like what's language and like what can we understand, and like is there like a truth or like the problem of like trying to find yourself, and how these are all like metaphysical ideas.
Yeah.
Everything's kind of dependent on like a language kind of constrains your thought and stuff. And I do feel like the two like relate. It's funny.
They do.
But I agree with him. That it's very. And also, I just feel like this theory of everything, the theory of everything, I feel like it's got some of the faith in a God, except it's the faith in physics.
I agree with you, actually. So we're going to talk about what I call the mathematical multiverse, I guess, in my book here. Tegmark throws out this idea, and he calls it the mathematical universe hypothesis. And I actually categorize this as a faith-based multiverse, because I actually agree with exactly what you're saying, because what we're going to say are a couple of things that I think you just have to take on faith. One is, Tegmark says, there exists an external reality that is independent of us. And that, I think, is on par of religion and metaphysics and philosophy. The truth is, it sort of underlies scientific methodology. I don't personally know of an instance in science where this isn't really the operational premise. Because otherwise, what are we doing? Because the whole idea is I measure something and describe it as best I can such that you can repeat the measurement. And that only works if there's sort of this external reality that we're each checking in on and each describing. So I think that this is one of the primary premises of the religion of science. And I do actually look at that as sort of religion, because I cannot prove this to you scientifically, right? I don't know how to do that. But I believe it underlies what we're doing. So Tegmark says, okay, first of all, let us assume that. All right? And honestly, it's sort of funny, because by the time I get through describing this, I'm going to have described something that most scientists would go, that's totally wacko. But his starting point is not wacko to what I think most scientists would say. So we have an external reality that is completely independent to humans, okay? Yep. Yep. I think most scientists would say that's the case. So then the other thing is, if there is this external reality, a lot of what physics has been all about all along has been to uncover a theory that describes that external reality as completely as possible. And so that's what we really mean when we talk about this theory of everything. And I think most physicists would agree that's the ultimate goal. I mean, that's what Einstein wanted to do. Okay? So there's nothing on this page that I think most scientists would have any issue with, but it's pretty, you know, it's starting to be religious. And then we come to the point that you made about language. If we're going to have a theory of everything, it cannot be in music or English or German, because any of those descriptions has room for ambiguity. A theory of everything would have to be self-contained and unambiguous. Totally self-contained, right? So, if it's a theory of everything, you can't look at it and go out and get an encyclopedia or a dictionary to define something. It has to be encased within, okay? So the bell just rang, so we're going to have to go. But Tegmark says, because we have to remove all these human-related baggage, all this human-related baggage, it must have a mathematical structure. Now, there's actually a religious statement, too, because I think, is mathematics something we invent, or is it something we discover? He's saying very clearly that he thinks it's something we discover. That mathematics is a set of principles and things, and humans are discovering pieces of that and relationships that exist. So is 2 plus 2 equal 4 a relationship we discovered, or did we sort of invent it? That's, again, that's sort of a philosophical thing. So there's the... Anyway, so we'll move from here, but you get some pretty strange stuff when you sort of make these assumptions that Tegmark is starting to make. So, your exams are here. U through Z, P through T, K through O, F through J, and A through E.